death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Hello, Zero Books readers and viewers. In this video, we'll be exploring the idea of paracon or participatory economics with Michael Albert and Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, all the way to the right, is, of course, the most well-known left dissident in America, perhaps the world, and he is an academic giant in linguistics. Michael Albert is the former editor of Z Magazine and former publisher of South Ends Press. Albert's book, No Bosses, is coming out soon from Zero Books, and it serves as both a simple introduction to paracon and a polemic aimed at the left, arguing that we should think through real alternatives to capitalism. So, Noam Chomsky, Michael Albert, thanks for coming on again. We tried this once and it didn't quite work, so thank you for participating in this conversation. I wanted to start out by asking Noam a question. Noam, you've said a key element of anarchism, or really, I think you would say, of any worthy attitude about social life, is that there should be an onus on arguing for vesting authority There should be an onus on arguing for vesting authority in some above others. In other words, if someone wants to claim authority, they should make a really compelling argument for taking that authority. Authority requires justification. I think that's a powerful norm. I would think it would imply right off that there should be no private ownership of workplaces, of resources. But I'm wondering what other kinds of implications do you think that social norm has?
Holds for everything from families to international affairs. The crucial element relevant here is Mike's point about no bosses. That is, any arrangement among individuals in which some give orders and some take them has to have a very strong justification. Sometimes I think it can, like traffic rules. I think it makes sense to have people compelled by the community, by community decision, to obey traffic rules. That now extends to questions like vaccine mandates. Children going to school aren't allowed to school without a polio vaccine. Measles vaccine should extend to COVID vaccines. I think that's a legitimate use of authority made. It should be made by a democratic vote of an informed participatory community. It's not the way it works here, but should work like that. But I think those would be especially under proper social conditions, legitimate exercises of authority. And I think you can find others. But for a community to function and survive, it'll have to have norms that people accept. We hope accept not only voluntarily, but with understanding and commitment. So the idea that you shouldn't be, that if, say, you send your kid to school, you should be confident that there's no kid in the class that's spreading polio. I think that's important. It's a fair kind of decision that should be made. And I think we can find them in many other places. But the crucial point is that a justification is always needed. The burden of proof is always on those who call for some form of authority by some over others.
I have a question that isn't on my little list that is perhaps a distraction, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I actually have a 16-year-old son who has a phobic reaction to needles, and we've taken him to get the vaccine 3 times now, and every time he's unable to get the vaccine. Do you think
a phobic reaction?
Yeah, like he'll fall to the floor and writhe around.
Is that for any vaccine or for this one?
No, all of them. Like, we've been trying to get him vaccinated on a dozen different ways.
Like polio, measles, and so on, the standard ones.
Yeah, when he was younger, he got vaccinated. But then as he got to be around 12, 13, he developed this phobia.
And so the issue is the needle.
Yeah, the issue is the needle. But my question is, should someone like my kid who has this phobic reaction be, and who actually would like to have the vaccine, and maybe with his consent we could do this, but let's say that he is not willing to do this, be made to stay home from school or do you think that would be a proper use of authority, or the other option is to put him under and give him the vaccine? Yeah, which he might just knock him unconscious.
Possibilities. He could go to school and sit separately with a mask.
Right, which is what he does. I mean, that's what they're going to be doing, right?
But I mean, you have to protect the other people. It's like somebody says, I don't want to drive on the right, or I don't want to stop at a red light. It's too dangerous for others.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Michael, do you agree with this norm, this idea that every act of authority really should require justification? And do you think that the way that Noam focused on it left some centrally important implications out? Would you want to expand on it?
Well, it's not so much that it left something out that had to be addressed. It's just that there are other things to be addressed. So if you have a norm like that and you apply it to the problem of thinking about the way society should operate, you probably don't think, at least I wouldn't think, that you continuously are having debates about whether or not something is warranted. Instead, you want to set up institutions in such a way that they sort of respect that norm, but you don't have to continually question everything, debate everything, come to some resolution about everything. It's a little like the norm is to say that people should be free up to the extent that it encroaches the freedom of others. That's another kind of a norm. I don't think any of these norms are perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect norm. There are always going to be exceptions. The one that I like is to say that people should have a say in decisions to the extent possible in proportion to the degree that they're affected by them. But if I'm making a decision that affects others greatly, then they are excluded from having a say in proportion to the degree that they're affected. And so what Noam is raising becomes relevant. The reason why the justification is required in every one of those examples is because the potential behavior on the part of one person is encroaching upon others and maybe even killing them. Obviously, they're dramatically affected. Now, none of these norms by themselves are institutions. None of them are a set of social relations that are abiding the norm, that are respecting the norm, that are actually fulfilling the norm. And so that step is still there to be taken when we agree on these things. If we agree that people should have solidarity, okay, what's the difference between an institution that produces solidarity and one that crushes it? What's the difference between an institution that only generates legitimate authority and one that generates illegitimate authority all the time? And what institutions have those effects? So I agree with Noam's sentiment and have for 50 years. But on top of it, I've felt the need to talk more specifically about structures to fulfill those kinds of values.
Noam, in various places in Michael's book, he acknowledges early anarchists and council communists for both what he calls self-management and, more instructively, I think, for his views on class hierarchy and particularly on the place of what he calls the coordinator class. Do you think he's right about the lineage there?
Well, first of all, they're not the same. The council communists were left Marxists, people like Paul Maddock, anti-Bolshevik Marxists, left, critical of both. They regarded Bolshevism as basically state capitalism and anti-Marxist as they understood it. And they were concerned primarily with management of production. So the Council of Communists were, they were basically came out of the Spartacist movement in Germany, which was crushed by social democratic force. Anarchists are all over the place. It depends which ones you're talking about. So Bakunin, for example, criticized Marx for imposing the rule of what Michael calls the coordinator class. Bakunin called it the state bureaucracy, but it extends more broadly in Michael's terminology and concepts. So I think it's fair to relate it to tendencies like Bakunin's, although he was not a very systematic thinker. You can pick this out, you can pick that out. But I don't, by and large, the anarchism is a very broad brush. You can find a lot of things in it, including this. So, for example, if you take a look at the anarchist revolution in Spain, it took many different forms. A lot of it was a peasant revolution. So it was getting rid of landlords, getting rid of church authorities, getting the government out of our hair. But how particular villages were organized, you really have to look. They vary. A lot of it was what we call spontaneous, but meaning variable. But of course, it came out of 50 years of struggle and education. It didn't just show up. So anarchism is too broad a brush to be able to say council communism was pretty well-defined, left Marxist, production-oriented. Workers take control of production by direct participation in every aspect of management and decision-making.
Can I ask you a question about council communism, again, off the script? When you look at the, I mean, I agree with you completely with the Council of Communists and with Paul Maddock that the Soviet Union was state capitalist, ultimately. but when you look at Russia at that time, it would have been difficult for workers to take control of much when there wasn't much of a developed working class in the country. And I think the project, the way the Bolsheviks thought of it was, we get rid of the aristocracy, we get rid of the czar, we develop a capitalist state, and then when Germany has its revolution, we continue on and develop socialism in the Soviet Union. That's when we start to be able to. But we can't have worker control until we have a working class, was sort of the idea. And of course, that failed. Because Germany didn't have its revolution, and even if it had, who knows what would have happened. But do you think that the Bolsheviks were aiming at state capitalism with the aim of, like what I said, to then move to socialism, or was it more nefarious than that?
I think if you asked Lenin and Trotsky, what do you want to get to ultimately? They'd say a communist anarchist society. In fact, Engels came pretty close to saying that in debates with anarchists. He said, yes, we agree on the end. Means. On the other hand, the means that you carry out do have an effect on the ends that you achieve and even on your own way of looking at things. Aside from that, I think it's a little too fast to say that there was no proletariat. There was an industrial proletariat. It was not very different from the peasant society. A worker in St. Petersburg would go back to his village, let's say. But even the peasant society had many radical participatory characteristics. And Marx himself, towards the end of his life, had gotten very interested in Russian peasant society. The Narodniks had done extensive, detailed work studying the peasant society, and Marx used their works and was rather impressed with it and was even toying with the idea that there might be peasant-based revolutions. These are his correspondence with Vasulich, that the urban Marxists, the major Marxists, mostly suppressed for a long time, but finally came out. And if you take a look at what was happening on the ground in 1917, the revolutionary year, it was pretty complex. Actually, the first serious study of this just came out about a year or two ago, Christopher Reed's book, which is actually the first one to do detailed study, not just of what leaders and intellectuals were saying to one another, but what was actually happening on the ground. And I think it shows that the radical initiatives were coming basically from the people, not from the leadership. The leadership was trying to shape and control them in accord with their own goals and ideals. Even just the Bolshevik dismantling of the social revolutionaries and the Constituent Assembly undermined a large part of the popular base for revolution. They wanted to take control. What their goals were, you could debate, but there is a relation between means and ends. If you dismantle the factory councils because you have some ultimate communist ideal in mind, you're eliminating the basis for achieving it. So I don't think it's a simple story. I mean, they were also under attack very soon. Raises big problems. You can raise questions about how Trotsky, with the Red Army, crushed the anarchist movement in the Ukraine, for example. Was that a legitimate act? I don't think so. Or the crushed the Kronstadt uprising later. Mm-hmm. So I think there's lots of detailed questions to raise, but I think asking what they might have had in their mind as an ultimate ideal is not really a very useful approach to the analysis of what was happening.
Well, I would say that the reason to ask it is not to evaluate their moral character, but to ask whether or not exactly what you said, the means that were used undermined the project, and to what extent, let's say, industrialization is necessary for socialism. You know, you pointed to a radical participatory economics sort of existing or being developed in the peasant classes. So it may be that people who are Marxists who believe that industrialization and or like getting to capitalism as a step towards socialism is necessary are wrong on that front. And you know, so it's worthwhile to not, you know, morally blame Lenin as a authoritarian monster, but to also pick apart the assumptions and that might have been developed by the means that were deployed. But I'm going to stop this tangent now and go back to Michael. Michael, what does what you have both been saying so far, and ignoring the bit about the Soviet Union, mean to you for thinking about the label of socialism and about the various experiences that have been, that have called themselves socialists. And maybe you don't have to ignore the bit about the Soviet Union.
Probably can't with that question.
Right.
Well, first of all, the word, I guess it connotes at an emotional level and maybe at a philosophical level, I think, a degree of what Noam was talking about much earlier, people having control over their own lives, people being in a position to determine their pursuits, people having the circumstances and the material means comparable to other people and so on. But the trouble is that those values or aspirations are not the same as a particular set of institutions which can or might not fulfill them. So, you know, the word socialism has been used for, say, the Soviet Union, to give an example. The Soviet Union or the Soviet elites use the word socialism to capture the, you know, the quality of goodness that was associated with the word and the quality of meeting the needs of the people that was associated with the word. It's not that different than people in the West using words like freedom and democracy, meaning by democracy, real participation. So they're using words that have a cachet, but they don't have much connection to the actual aspirations of the leaders. And I think that was true of socialism in the Soviet Union. I think they got pretty much what they aimed for. They got pretty much what the means that they adopted were consistent with, what the level of analysis that they had and the components of the analysis were consistent with, meaning there wasn't that much attention on the political side to the influence of authority and hierarchy and the way it manifests and spreads throughout society and curtails options. And on the economic side, there wasn't that much attention to what I would want to call a class between labor and capital, a class I call the coordinator class. Some people call it the PMC. Call it what you will, doesn't matter. It's a group of people whose circumstances are empowering, whose work is empowering, whose conditions and whose acts lead them to have a degree of confidence and a degree of knowledge and a degree of skill and connection to others, which are all commensurate to being decision makers. And another set of people, more like 80%, who are doing work that is opposite to that, that is disempowering, that leaves one less aware of the circumstances of the economy, less confident, less connected to others, and so on. And so you get out with the old boss, in with the new boss. So I would say one version of socialism is what I would call a coordinator class economy. Now, the state might be more or less democratic, more or less authoritarian, more or less dictatorial, but just talking about the economy, that's one version, that one thing that's called socialism, except nowadays it's called 20th century socialism. It's no longer just called socialism by most people, and they have in mind those models. Another word, use of the word socialism, doesn't have anything to do with the one thing that was taken as a bedrock of socialism, which was an end to private ownership. It's rather more social democracy. It's more about having a working class that's more powerful and that introduces into capitalism various policies that benefit the vast population. And that's called social democracy. And some people call it socialism. Bernie Sanders calls it socialism. He says, I'm a democratic socialist. Another version of socialism would be the thing that is in the book No Bosses, which is called participatory economics or participatory socialism, or I suppose you could just call it socialism if you don't mind that it'll confuse everybody. And that tries to be an economic model or an economic vision with some key elements and characteristics, not a big blueprint, but key features, whose key features are essential to have the kind of self-management, the kind of requirement of justification for authority, but also to have equitable distribution of resources and circumstances, and also to have solidarity, and also to have, and so it has a set of institutions that are different from 20th century socialism, different from social democracy, different from capitalism, and they either do or don't do a much better job of delivering the kind of life that we would aspire to, of delivering the kind of circumstances and control over our lives and equity and solidarity that we would desire to. And so that, you know, the word can be used in those various different ways. And it does confuse things. Nowadays, there are polls which show that young people are more critical of capitalism than of socialism. In reverse, they're more positive about socialism than about capitalism. That's quite remarkable. I mean, that's an incredible result. No matter what they mean by the word socialism, it's, I think, a very positive result. But it is true that most of the people taking that poll then asked, okay, what's socialism, would probably have a pretty hard time, you know, describing what they're for. And many of them nowadays would probably say, well, it's, you know, it's sort of what Bernie's talking about. And that's fine, because that is a big step forward. But it isn't a new economy that's fundamentally different than.
Just one little comment for a moment,
based on the discussion, you know, that preceded this. I don't think the Soviet Union was state capitalism. I think it's very misleading to decide in your head that there are two things. There's socialism, meaning an end to private ownership, a desirable society, and there's capitalism. This rules out the possibility that there's an economy that isn't capitalism, that doesn't have capitalists, that doesn't have private ownership, that is fundamentally less than what we want. And I would call that coordinatorism, an economy that's still class divided, in which 20% is still dominating 80%, but there's no capitalists. There's no private owners.
I hold with the Forrest Johnson or Johnson Forrest interpretation of state capitalism, which doesn't have capitalism defined the way you define it. It's primarily about the private ownership of the means of production, but more about the basically the production of commodities for sale in the market is the primary way, a mode of production, the primary way of distributing goods. And that one, a way which necessitates there being a propertyless working class that has nothing to sell but their labor, because you have to exploit labor time in order to create the value that then is exchanged in the market and so on, you know, based on Marx's Capital. And his analysis of capitalism.
If you have nobody who has private ownership, then everybody is a worker.
Right. Well,
there's no class division and there's no class rule. Well, you might not like it, but that's what you're saying.
Well, you could, I mean, you could have you could have public ownership through the state with elected representatives as a coordinator class. And also have everyone else in the culture can be considered a worker, but they're with stratifications between the workers based on competition between sectors. I mean, and they're all. But let me put that aside, because I want to ask Noam a question. He's been, you know, he should talk some. He's, you know, important to be here. But we can pick this up in another podcast, Michael. I want to ask about social democracy and the Bernie Sanders movement, and I'll throw in support for the Squad and AOC and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and ask the question, can we use those means to get to the kind of participatory economic that we desire, to get towards the socialism that Michael's been talking about? Or are we at risk, in the same way that Lenin was, of trying to use authoritarian means that undermine our ability to develop the socialism that we say that we want?
Who's that directed to?
That's directed to you. Yeah.
Oh, to me.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with what Michael said about Bernie Sanders. I think it's very desirable to move in the direction that he's describing. But it's mild social democracy, very mild. In fact, one of the associate editors of the world's major business journal, London Financial Times, Rana Faruhar, she sort of quipped in a discussion that if Bernie Sanders was in Germany, he could be running on the Christian Democrat program, the right-wing program, which is actually pretty well true. Take a look at his main demands. Universal health care, free higher education. It's all over the place. It's in Germany, Mexico, Finland. These are normal things in most societies. The United States is very retrograde in this respect. So I think it makes sense to bring the United States into the civilized world. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a study by the main monitor of these things, Commonwealth Fund, a comparison of health systems around the world. They do it regularly. Of the richest countries, top, I think, 11 rich countries, the United States is last in just about every aspect of healthcare. It's the richest country in the world. Extraordinary advantages that no one else has to bring the United States into the civilized world with things like universal health care, free higher education, adequate daycare so that women can work without having double jobs of taking care of home and work. All of those things are very desirable. It's quite unlike the situation with the Bolsheviks, who took over the society and by compulsion ran it forcefully in a direction that they wanted. That's not what moving to mild social democracy is, just improving people's lives to the point where they can then be in a position to think seriously about deeper questions like, in our society, it's taken for granted that the best, if you're a young person, the best thing you can imagine is to have a job. You go back to the early Industrial Revolution, 19th century. Workers regarded having a job as a fundamental infringement on their elementary human rights. It means throughout your waking life, most of it, you're subordinated to someone else's orders. What's so great about that? In fact, for 2,000 years, back to the Romans, this was regarded as an intolerable infringement on basic human rights. The idea that having a job, meaning following somebody's orders for most of your waking life, the idea that that's a wonderful thing, I think that not only can be questioned, but I think questioning it is right below the surface. As soon as the question arises, people understand, yes, that's an exigency of life in this society, but we don't want it. So,
but you'd have to have land and do subsistence farming or have another alternative than spending money in the market to really have that position, right? I mean, for you to feel like that's an infringement on you rather than an absolute necessity for survival, you have to have the context of a way of life where you can sustain yourself. And in Rome, and they did hundreds of years ago, and even not that long ago in the United States, there was a lot more subsistence farming going on. But if you have a worker who has to get a way to buy his food in the market, then of course he's going to want that job.
Take the late 19th century. The United States did have a incipient working class. The working class was, and they didn't regard themselves as radical, but they were strongly opposed to having to be in a position where they have to take orders from others. The Knights of Labor, the main labor movement, its slogan was, those who work in the mills should own them and run.
Okay, right.
About the farmers, it wasn't subsistence farming. The farmers were organized. They wanted to form what they called a cooperative commonwealth. Mm-hmm. They wanted to get rid of the northeastern bankers and who, you know, provided the credit to buy crops and then controlled them by debt to arrange the marketing. They want to do it themselves, cooperatively. The real populist movement, not what's called populism today, but the populist movement of the 19th century was aiming towards, in fact, what they called a cooperative commonwealth, where farmers would work together in the common good, set up their own systems of planning, distributing crops, sending them to the general society, arranging for the financing, but in a cooperative manner. So I think it was, and in fact, the Knights of Labor and the populist movement were coming pretty close to combining. It was blocked by violence. It was a very violent society. Labor history in the United States is unusually violent as compared with other similar societies. And it was pretty much crushed by state and private force working together, you know, Pinkertons and National Guards and so on. But it came pretty close to moving towards a kind of cooperative commonwealth in which the industrial enterprises would be owned and run by the working class, and they would be working in coordination with organized farmer groups, which was, of course, the great mass of the society. And this was very widespread. I mean, the populist movement began in Texas and moved up to Kansas and Oklahoma. It was all over the Midwest. It's a really large part of the dominant part of the society.
Hold on a second. So I want to go back to the question I asked at the outset, because it didn't get answered, which was, do you think that when we are trying to achieve the kind of participatory economic system that Michael describes in his book, and that the working class wanted to create, as you described in the past, that we can do it by supporting the kind of social democratic movements? That is that a step towards socialism, or do we risk making a similar mistake to the kind that Lenin made?
No,
I didn't hear you address it.
Yeah. I don't think the comparison to Lenin holds. This the Sanders style social democracy is a good thing to pursue because it benefits people's lives. It brings the United States more or less into the civilized world. Okay, that's a desideratum in itself. I think secondarily, satisfying basic material needs in a decent way so that people don't have to be terrified of maybe getting a disease and, you know, having to throw out their meager life savings to try to deal with it. People get over that hump. Yes, then they can be in a position to work seriously on these deeper questions, which I think are not far below the surface. I think they come out very quickly, but you can't if you're in a situation of extreme privation. I mean, we're in a country where the majority, maybe 70%, says they're trying to survive from paycheck to paycheck. If you're in the gig economy, it's not even that. You're up to see if the boss tells you you're going to have to work 15 hours tomorrow, and then you don't get a job for the next couple of days. I mean, in that kind of society of precarious living, and I mean, this is the only country in the world where you have a phenomenon like deaths of despair. I mean, that's serious matter. It's mostly white working class people who are so despairing, they're just killing themselves, having an increase in mortality. Well, if Sanders-style social democracy can get you beyond that stage, it's a good thing, and it's a basis for working for something further, the kind of thing that Michael's talking about. Incidentally, when I talk about the 19th century, I don't mean to suggest that they were, that they had ideas of the kind that Michael's developing. It was just a sense that we want to get out of the control of the landlords, the banker, the Northeastern bankers, the mill owners, and so on. We want to do things ourselves. There wasn't much developed about where you go from there.
Yeah, it's possible that somebody could hear what Noam was saying, not this time, but at the start of the last one, the idea that the epitome of, or the apex of human fulfillment is to have a job. And you might hear that as saying, which I don't think Noam was saying at all, that you want to not work. That's not the point. The point was that you want to not take orders. You want to not go into work and become a cog in a machine. You want to not participate in the economy because you're compelled to, because you're under pressure to, and with no say, et cetera, et cetera. So what it points toward is an institutional problem. How do you organize allocation? How do you organize the workplace? How do you manifest the desire of workers so that when they're working, they're fulfilling a human capacity and a human need, and they're meeting the needs of themselves and others, then it's no longer such an onerous thing. It is, in fact, part of what it means to be a human being, and part of what it means to be fulfilled. So the trick is, or it's not a trick, the task is to conceive an economy and to organize an economy in a way that going to work, that is working to produce stuff that's going to meet human needs and develop human potentials, doesn't rob you of your humanity, but in fact enlarges and manifests your humanity. And that's what I think coming up with an economic vision is all about. How do we organize the division of labor? How do we arrange decision-making in the workplace? And how do we connect workplaces one to another and to consumers? So it's basically the kinds of questions that I think No Bosses addresses or tries to address. And, we'll see the extent to which it's a successful attempt.
So I want to go to you'd written down a question that I'm going to try to paraphrase. And Michael, if you think I'm getting this question wrong in the way I paraphrase it, correct me. Okay. But I see that that Noam, you and Michael have a lot of agreement about the kind of society and economy that would be desirable and that we might call socialism or that we could call participatory economics. But I wonder, Noam, if you have questions or problems with Pericon that you want to bring up or address with Michael. Are there things that still need to be developed and that would be worth developing even as we're in a phase where the best we're going to be pushing for at the moment is a social democratic reforms to get people out of misery?
I guess the main difference that I've had with Michael over many years of close friendship and collaboration is just I'm less confident. I think we just don't know enough about human beings to know how they're going to function under different circumstances. So I think when Michael says it's a skeleton or a framework, that I feel more comfortable with. I think a lot of options have to be tried. Even take markets. I mean, you can imagine ways in which markets could be used simply as an information gathering technique. Michael disagrees. But that's a possibility that could be pursued without any remuneration, any consequences to it. Just here's one of the ways to find out.
Okay.
Get some information on how production could be organized. Or take the question of people being compensated to the extent of their participating, to the extent that the decisions affect them. Well, that's a pretty fluid matter. Like, suppose you happen to be affected, not personally, but morally, by, say, the crushing of the population of Gaza. Well, you're not directly affected by it, but you should have reason for you to have a role in decisions about it. And as soon as we move into all of these areas, I think we find a fair amount of fluidity. Should there be small, family-owned, no-worker businesses? I don't happen to think so, but if people want to try that as a mode of organization, I don't think it should be blocked. Not with anyone giving orders, just mom-and-pop store, let's say. I don't really have a strong feeling about it. I think there are many ways in which human society could be organized, which would contribute to the ideals that we share. So that's my main question, is just less confidence.
Michael? Yeah,
Doug, when you said earlier what we could do now is fight for these social democratic gains, I think that's true. But I also think there's more than one way to fight for anything, for social democratic gains. So you can fight for, let's say, a $15 an hour minimum wage, or even a $25 an hour minimum wage. And it's an end in itself. That's what you're talking about. What you discuss is that and nothing else, et cetera. Or you can fight about it in a way that is attempting to prepare consciousness, organization, and desires to go further. And that's two different ways of approaching, in this particular case, the same reform. One way of approaching it tends to stop. The other way of approaching it tends to keep going. All right, so I prefer the latter way of approaching it. And then the question becomes, well, what composes the latter way of approaching it? How do you fight for a little more accountability, a little higher minimum wage, a little more, a better healthcare system, and so on and so forth. And at the same time, arouse and organize and facilitate fighting for more. And I think that in order to do that, it helps a whole lot to be able to couch what you're saying in terms of longer run goals. So that's why I think vision is very important for hope, for planting the seeds of the future in the present, and for how we talk about things. The issues that Noam raised, there's probably a lot of things that we would disagree about. That doesn't matter very much, I don't think, honestly. It's the core things and whether we disagree about them. So No Bosses says, for example, private ownership of productive assets is wrong. It should not exist. It means profits and control. And there's no argument that I can see for either, for the inequitability or for the power imbalance. So I don't, I come to the conclusion that even though we know that not that much about human nature and all the vast possibilities that exist in the future, I think we can rule that out. And if we do rule that out, we have to say, okay, then what is the mechanism for making decisions in a workplace? And what is the mechanism for apportioning the social product among people? We can leave it open, or we can think about it. And I think we should think about it. And in thinking about it, I think that guided by Noam's anti-authoritarian kinds of principles, we come up with the idea that the people who do the work should be making the decisions over the productive workplace, but the people who consume and who occupy the society, for instance, the pollution, also have a say. That's a tall order, right? to convey to the producers, to the workers, to the people who consume, and to the people who live in the communities and might smell the, you know, the pollution, to convey to them all an influence over the decisions and the outcomes. That's a tall order. And if we don't think about it, it's going to be hard to arrive at it. So thinking about it, we came up with participatory planning. Thinking about how to get rid of class division, on the one hand, you come up with get rid of the element of the economy that causes a certain set of people, let's say 2%, to be owners and capitalists. Get rid of that. That's private ownership out the window of productive assets. They should be, you can say they're collectively owned or they're owned by nobody. You basically are making a plea to borrow a factory, to use a factory. For what end? To benefit society. But anyway, if we say we want to get rid of that because we want to get rid of that ruling class element, that owning class, then I'm stuck saying, basically, well, we have to get rid of the thing that elevates 20% also. We want classlessness. We don't want 20% over 80%. And if that thing is that the 20% is more empowered, is more connected, is more knowledgeable, is more confident, then we have to ask what produces that. Oh, so it's partly school and upbringing and things outside the economy, but it's partly the kind of work that we do. It's partly that some people do empowering work and some people do disempowering work. And so I want to get rid of that. There's numerous reasons to get rid of it, but the main one in my eyes is to achieve classlessness. So, you know, these are the, Noam referred to a scaffold, which is what I like to call it, partly at his not insistence, but, you know, with his provocation. I think it's wrong to do a blueprint of a future society for the reason Noam gives. We don't know enough. There's another reason. It's not our right, right? It's not our right to decide for future people all these details of their lives. People will ask me, how long is the work week going to be? And I'd say, I don't know. You know, people in the future are going to decide how long they want to work, not me. But the responsibility that we do have, I think, is to think through the structures that are sort of necessary, essential. The few structures which, if we don't have them, we're going to have class division. We're going to have inequity. We're going to have, you know, the conflict of people against people that's the opposite of solidarity. And those are the structures that No Bosses addresses. And, you know, that's the motivation, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I want to ask one final question. We're coming up towards an hour, and I don't want to keep Noam Chomsky too long here. And thank you again for participating, Noam, and Michael, too. What I want to ask you both is, and I'll start with you, Noam, is this. You've both been on the left for quite a while, struggling for socialism for quite a while. You've seen a lot. I want to talk or ask you specifically about the 60s movement, which I think in many people's imaginations was the last time there was a real feeling of revolution on the left. You get things like what happened in Paris in 68, and even in the United States, there were many people who were on the left who thought that they were pushing forward a revolutionary struggle, and that a revolutionary struggle, sometimes for socialism, sometimes for something ill-defined. But would you say that at that time you were more optimistic about the kind of something like Paracon developing than you would be now? Or have we lost sight of the need for a radical transformation on the left? Is my question. I'll ask that of you first, Noam.
First of all, I think we shouldn't exaggerate what was happening in the 60s. Mm-hmm. There were things that were really, in fact, the most extreme, serious case that I can think of, not just tossing around slogans, was actually what Mike did. What Mike did, happened to be doing as a student, was more far-reaching than, in terms of institutional change, than anything else I can think of. Remember that the 60s are a time when the head of SDS, Paul Potter, when he was president of SDS, the most important left group among young people, gave an address in which he said, we have to have the courage to name the system. You couldn't use the word, it was too scary. But we've got to find it. We've got to get ourselves advanced enough so we can at least name the system we're opposing. Actually, if you look at his speech, he couldn't utter the word. To say the word capitalism was too scary. That's where we were on the stage of moving to a revolution. Okay? I think we're way beyond that now. A lot has happened, not just in the 60s, but in the aftermath. A good deal of the activism and organizing that has really had a major effect was the consequence of the 60s. So take, say, the feminist movement. The 60s was barely beginning, just barely beginning. Hints and bits and pieces of it there took off in the 70s. Environmental movement didn't exist, you know. Ideas about workers' control were in small groups of people who were thinking about history, you know. There was nothing like the extensive, deeply thought out proposals of the, like Paracon. It was not there. Nobody was talking about it. I never thought that Paris was a serious move towards any revolutionary change. The basis of it wasn't there. The mass of the population wasn't engaged in saying, yes, this is the direction we want to go. It was fluff on the surface. Same in the United States. When SDS broke up around 1970, just look where it went. One direction was to Maoists who were handing out the little red book at the GE factory to workers who just wanted to beat them up. I didn't know what they were talking about. The other was a weatherman who said, let's go down Main Street and smash up the windows and something will happen. I mean, it wasn't a revolutionary situation. I think it's much closer to that today. And I think actually activism is probably greater today than it was then. Then it was narrowly focused. Let's get the troops out of Vietnam. Let's have free speech on campus. Now it's much broader. And I think many more people are involved at one or another level.
Michael?
Yeah, I would concur with almost all of that. And so I won't repeat it. Instead, you know, there's the possibility of confusing uprising and anger, and there was plenty of that in the 60s, to be sure, and coordinated, insightful, aware desire for a new world. We would chant, we want the world and we want it now, but we didn't have any idea what the hell that meant. And I think I would agree that the current situation, it's not as tumultuous in some ways, and the culture doesn't have the component that existed then, which was very important. You know, it's called hippie culture. It was a rejection of many things. It wasn't an affirmation of a new society, but it was a rejection of certain ways of living and acting that was widespread then, and that was made it easy to organize. We didn't have to organize among the population. We could have the counterculture organize among the population, and then we could organize among the counterculture. It's a lot easier to do that than what's done now. But what's done now is, I think, arguably Noam's right about that, closer to reaching or trying to reach the population, trying to reach it with positive aspirations. When you ask, are you more hopeful now than then? Well, you'd also have to ask, are you more sane now than then? So, for instance, a lot of our hopefulness then was naive. And it was a function of the upheaval that was visible in many places. But it wasn't a function of underlying commitments. Now, the absence of some of that upheaval causes people to be less hopeful. But in many ways, this is a paradise for organizers. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it ought to be possible to organize in huge constituencies now. It may be that the biggest obstacle to success now isn't, in fact, repression, isn't, in fact, the effectiveness of the other side, but it's that our side hasn't quite understood yet how to reach out, how to involve people in a way that keeps them committed enough so that you can have sustained efforts at both the reforms you were talking about earlier and the bigger changes. And so I think I would agree. On the other hand, it's hard to be. I think your audience would probably think we're crazy unless we acknowledge that it's hard to be optimistic about things when the danger of pandemic, the danger of possible nuclear war, the danger of climate change are so pronounced. I'll throw in something that is a little, I'm curious, Noam, how you'd react to this. Obviously, the climate situation is incredible. However you describe it, whether you describe it as literally an existential threat to humanity's existence, or you describe it as a threat to humanity having civilization, whatever you describe it as, it is a humongous danger. And to my eyes, it's hard to imagine, maybe not impossible, but less probable than I would hope for, that in the next 10 or 15 years, the left is going to be the humane, concerned, aware political left is going to be strong enough to win the desired changes if all of capital is opposed to those changes. So the irony here is that I find myself hoping, however weird it is, that a significant portion of the corporate elite, of the capitalist class, comes to realize and to be willing to act on the fact that they're going to suffer too, that their world also is going to be demolished by ecological effects unless they take action. So that the left's task is going to be, with them aware of that and trying to make changes around that, and without that, I'm not sure we can succeed. But with that, our task becomes to prevent their changes from being so authoritarian and so centralist and so derogatory toward most sectors of society that it doesn't lead any further, trying to make sure that it's more equitable and get it to lean further. And when I use the word authoritarian there, I'm worried that there may be no way around that regarding climate change. So, for example, Noam, if Bernie became president, hell, if you became president, the task of doing multiple Manhattan projects, way larger than the Manhattan Project, to ward off climate disaster and ecological nightmare is probably going to involve a certain amount of authoritarian outcomes. And the left is just going to have to guard against all that. But arguing as if we are going to transform society into a participatory society in 10 years, and then a participatory society will revamp the direction of production so that the ecology will not be destroyed, that's not likely. And so, regrettably, the fate of the planet may depend on ruling class elements finding a modicum of sanity.
Well, I think that's true, but I'm not sure it's that much of a contradiction. So let's take concrete examples. take, say, the fossil fuel industry, coal industry, the owners, the bankers who fund them, they're not going to do anything. I mean, they may make, say, some nice words and then move on to greenwashing. Their interest is to maximize profit and power in the short term. But what about the workforce? Actually, there have been steps in that direction, interesting ones, like in West Virginia, coal country,
yeah,
which actually has a history of working class organization and activism. There are now significant moves among the mine workers, even the mine workers union, to face up to the fact that coal is going, but you can have better jobs and better lives by working together to turn to move towards sustainable energy. So we, the mine workers, will get together, take over these collapsing industries, devote ourselves to tapping mines, to working on, to being trained for, supported for solar energy, wind energy, other sustainable forms. That's going to take a national commitment. Actually, in capital terms, it's minuscule, but it'll take, it does take funds for sustaining people in a transition, for training, for setting up the basis for alternatives. But that can be done. And it can be done, and I think it came, it actually came pretty close in other cases. I take the housing financial crisis, 2008-2009. Well, the way it was handled at the government level was to bail out the perpetrators and kick everyone else in the face. That's Obama, basically. And that laid the basis for what finally became Trump. But there were alternatives. And if there had been a powerful enough popular movement, it might have moved that way.
Yeah.
Obama took over the, you know, the government took over the auto industry, basically, essentially nationalized it. Well, what they did is give it back to the owners and have them produce, you know, Humvees. What they could have done, and with enough popular pressure, could have been compelled to do, is hand it over to the workforce and develop what the society needs, like mass public transportation. I don't think it was very far from that. What was missing was the popular activism, which could have pushed it that way. And I think the same is true in things like fossil fuels and other parts of the economy.
I don't disagree with you that it's possible. I hope that that can happen. I talk to people. I mean, I just finished spending a long time talking to a labor organizer in Pennsylvania. We talked about two things that bear upon what you're describing, I think. The first was the extent to which, take Amazon's response to the organizing in Alabama. And I expressed to him that I thought that Amazon's response was basically sort of the threat of a good example argument in a labor situation, that they realize that the whole thing is a pile of cards, and that if Amazon workers really started to get organized and really started to see the possibility of that, who knows what you could have? You could have a massive strike at Amazon in which workers were basically sitting down and making huge demands. And the other one was Western Pennsylvania, and his assertion that the possibility of garnering support in Pennsylvania talking about fracking was impossible. And I said, well, what if the formulation was that nobody loses their income, that those jobs disappear, those companies disappear, but nobody loses their income. Everybody is retrained in order to be able to work at, ecologically sound and also humanly sound jobs. And he said, yeah, but a lot of people are 50 or 45 or 55, and they don't want to start over. I said, fine, those people get an income and don't start over. They get early retirement. And you're right, the money isn't the issue. The issue is that once these kinds of steps are taken, it's a slippery slope towards something dramatically different for society. Call it participatory socialism, call it whatever you want. And the other side understands that. And that's why the other side fights so hard, like in the plant in Alabama. So the relative absence of effective left organization able to organize, it isn't a question. What you're saying is if the organization is there and if the activism gets strong and if the demands are made, the effect can happen. I agree with you. It's the first step that I'm not so sure can happen quickly.
But we're not in disagreement about that. It leads to the same conclusion. Our activism should be directed towards making that first step happen.
Exactly. I agree. But he asked, how optimistic are you? And I think that first step will be a little easier with Sanders in office than with Biden in office. And it would also be a little easier if there was a sector of the ruling class who was complaining about, and I think this is starting to happen, was complaining about the fact that they too are going to be up the creek without a paddle if things aren't done soon. Those two effects will help that grassroots organizing tremendously.
Well, we can do something about the first part, not the second part.
Actually, the second part, that's the irony. Yeah.
Second part, it's not that a large part of the reason why you're getting the rhetoric about being socially responsible.
Just buy off the opposition. I get it. Yeah.
Popular pressure.
Yeah.
What they call reputational risk. So Bank America has to agree to stop financing fossil fuels because too many people are just going to pull out.
Right.
But you can do things there too. And I think the things that are happening with the mine workers in the union are suggestive. It can come right from the working class.
Yeah, those are
the revival of the labor movement, which is critical.
Incredibly exemplary. I agree.
I want to know how optimistic I am. Not very much, but
that was my question.
Possibilities are there, and we have to pursue them.
I think I don't think we disagree.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you both for coming onto the channel. This will be going up tonight. And Noam Chomsky, this is the third time you've been on the Zero Books channel. I bet you had no idea. But thank you both for coming here. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.